one thing in the nonprofit industry that nonprofits need to learn from for-profits, and I think for-profits are at risk of doing this when they start a nonprofit, is they don't do market research. They just think, oh, if there's a need, of course I should fill it. But there are, in the United States, there are like 1.7 million nonprofits. I think they account for like 25% of the workforce. It's pretty significant. So before, just like in a regular for-profit business, before you start a nonprofit, you should research what other nonprofits are out there. How are people solving this problem? What is the true need, right? Like same way you would a for-profit business, just because it's your passion doesn't mean there's a business there. And it doesn't mean that there's a nonprofit there, right? So you really need to do that research. And then remember that.
Welcome to the Business Ownership Podcast, brought to you by Awareness Strategies, helping you navigate the waters between entrepreneurship and ownership. Hey there, peeps. This is Michelle Nedlock, and I'm super glad that you're here with us today because I'm here with my most amazing guest, Sarah. Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So give us kind of the 5,000 foot view of who you are and what you love to do in business.
Sure. Well, I'm a reluctant entrepreneur. Well, not anymore, but I owned like three businesses before I called myself an entrepreneur. I have a background in nonprofits. I actually started out, my first CEO job was as an executive director of a nonprofit. Then I founded a nonprofit. Then I shifted to starting my own for-profit business and then a second for-profit business, which was actually a cafe and art supply store. So like totally different end of the business spectrum. And then I decided to build a marketing agency, which somebody told me I needed to niche, right? We were having this conversation about oftentimes in businesses, we need to niche. I niched into nonprofits because that's where I really had a lot of insight. And then, you know, sometimes like you're trying to build your business towards a vision and other times your business like decides it's going to be something else. So right. That happened to me. And I realized that I needed to be teaching nonprofits how to run better and how to grow and scale and be more consistent in how they work. And so that's basically what I do mostly with nonprofits, but what I've come to be a specialist in both business and nonprofits. I've come to see them as they are businesses, just like all businesses. And as businesses, they have this very complex structure. So not everything that works in for-profit works in nonprofit, but almost everything that works in nonprofit works really well in for-profit. So I enjoy working with for-profit businesses as well now.
Very cool. So what are some of the aspects that you noticed that were pertinent to you that other people just weren't noticing? You're talking about these aspects of business. What are these aspects that they're not noticing? And then we'll go into what is the differences.
Sure. Well, nonprofits usually start with kind of two businesses at once. One is their fundraising business, which has like its own set of messaging and its own set of clients, if you will. They're the donors. And then it also has whatever its mission-oriented business is, which is, you know, if it's serving people, it might be, you know, let's say people with mental health issues and it's providing services. So very few businesses start from day one needing to launch essentially two but interconnected businesses at the same time. So that's tricky, right? If you told a for-profit business to do that, the advice would be don't.
Yeah, exactly.
And every nonprofit by law starts with a board of directors with a minimum of three people. So now from day one, you get kind of things that like large corporations that are public have to deal with, but these are like potentially teeny nonprofits. They could be big nonprofits too, but they're dealing with that dynamic of having a board of directors from day one. Although nonprofit boards are a little different because typically the board members are not paid, which creates a whole bunch of problems, which maybe we won't get into, or maybe we will, but that's a can of worms. So those are kind of like the two biggest thing. And then the third thing is I just like to say in general, in nonprofits, there are more people per dollar. So you have to have really good systems. I mean, most businesses who've grown, right, they have to start dealing with like, oh, how do we handle a lot of people, right? Like, mm-hmm. how do we keep everybody rowing in the same direction? How do we make sure we hire the right kind of people? Well, nonprofits just have more and more people, and they don't necessarily have, like, they can't just throw money at all their problems, although I'm a big fan of well-funded nonprofits. But that's a lot. That's a lot of complexity to manage when you're having a group of volunteers and a group of staff and a board and all the people maybe that you're serving and so on.
Well, yeah. And I always pictured that to be kind of like herding cats, because it was, to me, it's yes, you have board members, but are they doing what they need to do? Because they don't have necessarily a vested interest in the company, unlike a public company or something else that would have a for-profit that would have a board of directors. Usually they have money in the game, and that's why they're interested, and that's why they're on the board, is because they want to make sure they have some direction in there.
You totally just nailed that. Is the crux of the problem is this managing, you know, board that has quite a bit of legal power, doesn't really have any skin in the game. They've got really nothing to lose if they mess up, and that creates a lot of problems.
Wow, I can well imagine. And I also assume that a lot of people that are starting them have a passion project, and they don't really understand the business side of things. So they're getting their friends and their, you know, cousins to be on the board. And it's like, oh, that was a mistake. How hard is it to get somebody off the board of a nonprofit when you don't want them there?
So it depends on your bylaws. So nonprofits have to establish bylaws. Depending on what state they're incorporated in, there'll be some basic rules about what has to be in them. But as far as whether or not board members have to leave after a certain amount of time, or that whole process is defined by the bylaws. And sometimes the ability to change, oftentimes the ability to change those bylaws is dependent on a certain majority vote from the board. And some bylaws stipulate that they need like a 2/3 vote rather than just a majority vote to change them. So it can get tricky if you started off with bad bylaws. I'll put that in air quotes, right? So I think I always like to think of effective, not effective, as opposed to bad and good.
Exactly.
So effective bylaws, right, would have an out. Like either some good ones are if somebody missed a certain number of meetings, like 3 consecutive meetings in a row because they're not showing up. I was once on a nonprofit board where they had a board member. They were not sure if he was still alive. So, you know, it's a little sensitive area, but they're like, how do we count? Do we have a quorum or not? Like, he never hasn't shown up in many, many years, like a decade.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So, and no way of getting a hold of him.
No way of getting a hold of him. They completely lost touch. So it's always good to have like a few, you know, systemic type safeguards in place. Like if they don't show up, they're automatically off. We don't have to worry about, you know, forcing them to come or, you know, if they died.
Well, and I'm also assuming, naive me, that you would have to have them legally written up. No. So wouldn't like your lawyers have some experience in this? No. Oh,
there's a lot of financial oversight for nonprofits. The IRS is watching closely. If you should be taxed, they want to tax it. But, you know, state by state, potentially, you know, if there was a state law that said in your state where you're incorporated that, you know, there's certain things that you have to do. So like, I'm based in New York State. I work with clients all over, but I happen to know the New York State law more closely. And there's certain stipulations, like if you're selling the majority of your assets, they tell you the exact percentage of vote. I think it's 2/3, but it's higher than normal. So they tell you exactly how many of the board percentage of the board needs to vote. And there's like certain minimum of how many board members you have to have. But apart from those things, there's no nonprofit police. There's nobody really to write up anything to. They are really, the board is the one that needs to be providing that oversight. And when they're not doing it well, there isn't really anything to do about it.
Well, let's add a level of complexity, because I've noticed myself just observing other entrepreneurs is that there seems to be a trend for for-profits to have a nonprofit kind of wing or sister company, much more so than there ever has been before. Have you noticed that? And if so, what's going on?
I can't say that I've seen it as a trend, but I also haven't been looking. So it could be there. You know, mostly nonprofits come and talk to me. So I think, you know, there one, there are some legal areas that a lot of people don't know. And actually, if I've seen a trend, it's the number of for-profits trying to do like, you know, if you shop with us, a certain percentage will go to this charity, you know, kind of a, and maybe you pick your own charity. And there's a lot of ignorance, both from for-profits and nonprofits, around the legality of doing this. So that's one thing that has caught my eye. It's technically, for those who want to Google it, if you're somehow using that nonprofitiness to as part of your kind of marketing scheme, right? Because yep. We give 5% and you can pick your nonprofit or something like that. It's called a corporate co-venture. And there is a lot of laws and it goes state by state. And so like, let's say you have an online store, you now have to comply. Not all 50 states have regulations with corporate co-ventures, but a good chunk of them, like 35 of them, something like that. And you have to actually get permission in all those states and file return, like special kind of returns in all those states. And so it gets tricky fast. But I think there's other cases where it does make sense for a corporation to channel some of its profits into a foundation. It's nice branding for the corporation to be like, look, we have this like offspring and then that's a charitable offspring. And then to do something with that, I think is a great pairing.
Let's see. Now that always made sense to me from a big business perspective, because in my experience, and feel free to totally correct me if I'm wrong, because all I'm going is what I've heard, is that once you get to a certain size, in order to be able to take the money out of the company, there's only certain ways you can do it. You can either pay tax or you can decide where you want it to go. And you start a school or you start a university, you get some notoriety from it that way. And it's almost like forced philanthropy in that, also in my kind of, want to call it the spiritual understanding of the world, is as soon as we acknowledge the fact that we can do what we want to do and we have all these skill sets, then all of a sudden, okay, it's not about me anymore. And now it's about how do I give to the community in order to get that sense of purpose and fulfillment. So to me, the two kind of fell hand in hand. And I'm just starting to see that other companies, well, then there was a big thing about, Giving Tuesday, mm-hmm. to be able to spontaneously do that. And I think it's kind of ironic that there's laws in place against small business doing it, whereas the laws are very much in favor of large companies doing it.
Yeah. You know, I think giving to charity is a great, like, it's a great way to use some of your profits in a way that you have control over, like you said. And it's also really good for, like, you know, staff feeling like a bond, right, to your for-profit, like, we support this. You know, I think where one thing in the nonprofit industry that nonprofits need to learn from for-profits, and I think for-profits are at risk of doing this when they start a nonprofit, is they don't do market research. They just think, oh, if there's a need, of course I should fill it. But there are, in the United States, there are like 1.7 million nonprofits. I think they account for like 25% of the workforce. It's pretty significant. So before, just like in a regular for-profit business, before you start a nonprofit, you should research what other nonprofits are out there. How are people solving this problem? What is the true need, right? Like, same way you would a for-profit business, just because it's your passion doesn't mean there's a business there. And it doesn't mean that there's a nonprofit there, right? So you really need to do that research. And then remember that, you know, we have this word charity, which is kind of a nice word because it's like, oh, we're helping. But the truth is most nonprofits are working to solve the world's most complex unsolved problems. And so kind of my big dream for the world is that nonprofits as business entities are seen as the very best innovators of all businesses, because you have to be an incredible innovator to solve things like hunger and homelessness, you know, and mental health challenges and cancer. But unfortunately, as a culture, we tend to tell nonprofits that they shouldn't take risks, that they shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't be doing these things. You have to take risks to innovate. And so, you know, there are plenty of people who go out in the world thinking I'm doing charity and that's good, but not all forms of help are created equal. And you are perfectly, it is easy to fall into thinking you're helping and actually not be helping, not making the problem better, not getting at the core issues. And so it is really, I think it's really important to be thinking about starting a nonprofit from that perspective of we need to be innovative, we need to be agile, we need to be experimenting, we need to be trying things. And yeah, we're going to fail a lot. And that's great. Because right, that's how we innovate. And if you support a nonprofit, you should be thinking of the same, like, how can I support them in experimenting and testing programs and having beta tests, all those things.
Nice. So I think this is a good time to foray into the, what's the difference fundamentally between the nonprofits and for-profits?
You know, at the end of the day, from a legal perspective, it's just a tax status. So nonprofits don't have to pay tax on their profits. Mm-hmm. And they also can't be owned. So nobody owns a nonprofit. So you can have profits, but you can't sell the profits. Nobody owns the profits, right? So basically they always have to be reinvested, or, you know, they can be saved as reserves. That's like a form of reinvestment. But so they're kind of interesting in that they are ownerless, which has some positives and some negatives, right? We kind of talked about like accountability, right? If you don't own it, if you don't have skin in the game, that can create challenges. So they're kind of unique in that way. And then I think the other way is, you know, we have this social enterprise world that's really grown, and I think that's exciting. So I think you find what's the difference between a nonprofit and a social enterprise is really that nonprofits are, all businesses solve problems, right? But nonprofits solve problems, hopefully, right? Sometimes they have to make the problem to solve it, but.
Exactly.
Nonprofits solve problems that really aren't profitable. You know, sometimes some nonprofits solve problems that are profitable. Some solve problems that will just barely pay for themselves. And some solve problems where they're always going to need to run this kind of fundraising business because there just isn't going to be, you're not going to get a financial return. But you have this other kind of, you know, we talked about, you know, ROI, right? Return on investment. And I think, you know, nonprofits have return on impact or return on mission, right? They have that other kind of ROI. And that's really important too. If our goal is to make the world a better place in one way or another. And as business leaders, I'll call them, because they're not owners, like nonprofit CEOs and leadership teams are really always balancing these two pieces. I like to call them mission pie and money pie. And so like, we're always making both kinds of pie and they're kind of interconnected. And we have to be both good at knowing how to make money and good at knowing how to make a mission. And we're constantly thinking, well, you know, right now, am I making a mission at a cost, you know, at a loss? I'm kind of like a loss leader in marketing, or do I need to be focusing on money? So it's a more complex balancing act.
Nice. Well, and I noticed too, that when companies have that mission pie in their for-profit businesses, it almost makes it easier to be able to market and to create a kind of everybody's going in this direction, because ultimately we're doing this. Yes. We're, you know, for example, us, yes, we're helping business owners build their businesses and make them stronger. But at the same time, we have a mission to help everybody on the planet become an entrepreneur, which then, you know, it's like, well, okay, so you got more skin in the game. It's not just, hey, how do we make money? How is this transactional? It's no, we actually want to hug our clients at the end of the day and, you know, and help them to succeed and be independent.
Yeah. I mean, missions help all businesses, I think. The difference is a nonprofit may go for mission at the expense of profit, and a for-profit typically won't, right? They kind of draw the line at the point that they're losing gobs of money. They will not choose mission over profit. They'll pick another mission.
Tried that one, didn't work. We're not liking that.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. So when it comes to, say, starting businesses, let's go for profit. What are some of the things that people need to consider other than they're solving a problem for somebody? They've done some research. They've got those going on. That's helpful. I noticed a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah, that's true.
The successful ones, or the ones that at least have more wind in their sail, tend to do those kind of things. But when it comes to the fundamentals of business, what kind of things do people need to set up that they're just not taking into account?
I think, you know, if for business owners to take something from hindsight is, if you really want a wildly profitable, make a lot of money business, all of those people who end up with those types of businesses have them because they fell in love with running business. And those, which is totally me. I just love, like, any kind of business is interesting to me. It's fascinating. But those people who really just, they had a passion, service, or product, and their passion was really all about the thing that they wanted to sell in business, that never goes as far. And you, it's okay to start there. But I think if I were to kind of restart my business journey all over, I would want to ask, am I doing this? You know, could I see myself falling in love with business? Let me learn about how business works. It's not rocket science, actually. It's not that hard. You can just grab a few books and start to get a taste for it. But just, you know, and then decide, am I going in that I love business and I'm growing businesses direction? Or am I just going to see if I can turn this passion thing that I love into a business? And if not, then I'll just go do something else. I think that's one thing that's really important. And otherwise, that, you know, there are many forms of business and there's a lot of advice out there. I always like to say, you know, most of the advice is good, but if you pay for it, you're more likely to follow it. And following the advice is the hard part. I encourage everybody to pay for some advice for that reason at some point. And I think, you know, choice, right? There are many forms of business, many ways of doing business. You know, it's great to have like a, you know, $500,000 a year business that has just you, maybe a virtual assistant, and you just are like super profitable. That's great. It's great to be a multi-million-dollar business. It's a wild ride to travel from like 3 million and like cross that like 15, get to like 20 million boundary. Like, it kind of depends how much you love being a CEO, how much you love working with people, you know, how much you love complexity. And there are lots and lots of great, great paths. So just always remember as you start to navigate it, that you get to choose what kind of business you have and where your time goes in that business.
Nice. So when you're working with people and helping them to kind of streamline their business, what kind of things are you looking for?
I like to look at kind of three main categories. I like to look at capacity, right? Your ability to do anything at all. I like to look
job
at
done.
Strategy. Or I call it actionable strategy, because sometimes people make strategies and then they don't do them. And that's pointless in my opinion.
Very much
sometimes
so.
People make strategy that they don't have capacity for. And it, at some point, I think if you have to do one before the other, and it's always, if you don't have enough capacity, you might as well build up some capacity, because, you know, there's no point in saying like, we're going over there if you, you know, if you're on a tiki raft. Well,
and that to me is just a terrible plan. It's okay, here's the bane of my existence with coaches and people who do that. That's not a strategy. That's an ego on paper, and it pisses me off. In order to have a strategy, I need to know where I am right now. And if I got three widgets under my, you know, that I can produce a month, great, awesome. Don't give me a plan that involves 257 of them. I want to go from 3 to 4 to 5 to 6, to right. 7. And at no point am I missing any number, because numerically I can't not, I can't make 10 without making 7 first. Yeah. So to me, it's in order to have a sound strategy, it has to include where you are right now and what are we doing. It's got to have a reverse engineering component to it too. Absolutely. What are we doing now that I'm out of the meeting? What's the first phone call I make? What's the first email I send? What am I doing differently than I did when I walked into that meeting in order to start implementing this new system? So if your strategy does not include that, either, you know, fire them, sue them, do what you got to do. That is not a strategy. Get them back to the table and get a real one.
I couldn't agree more. I like to say, like, I want my strategy to be like my turn-by-turn GPS, right? It
Absolutely.
Should say, turn left out of the driveway, go 300 feet, right? And so many people like, oh, I hate it when people are like, oh, we're going to act strategically. And I just like, to me, strategy is goals, and the steps or tactics or whatever you want to call to achieve those goals. And it really should be, and it needs to include how you're going to get the capacity to do the next kind of phase of your strategy.
And not only what are you doing, but what aren't you doing?
Yes.
That we're not doing this anymore because it doesn't fit in with this arrow. You know, if I shoot the arrow from where I am to the apple, nothing else matters except for that trajectory.
So I'll dive into that just a little deeper because I think I struggled with goals for so many years. And the big aha to me was, you know, goals come in pairs. There is the outcome or the reaction that you do not have control over. And we start businesses to get those kinds of outcomes. And then there are the things we are goals too, but we do have control over. So like, I might want to, you know, talk to some, you know, business person I admire. I can't force them to talk to me, but I can like send them an email and make a phone call and comment on all their social media, right? So my goal that I'm going to take action on, where all those steps, you know, that you're talking about are going to live, is under the thing I do have control over. And then I'm going to be evaluating, is the goal that I set out that I have control over, is it producing the result that I want? No, like, oh, well, I thought that, you know, doing more social media was going to get me more people giving me their money, but turns out my people aren't on social media, right? So I need to stop doing that activity. I still want that outcome. I'm just going to pick a whole nother type of activity to do that. So I think that's really critical in making a strategy actionable.
Absolutely. And I think that's where at least at minimum your quarterlies come into play. And depending on how aggressive your activity is, it could be monthly, it could be weekly to be able to assess, is this.
For nonprofits, there are a lot of great business operating frameworks for for-profit businesses, but there, when I started really working on this with nonprofits, there was nothing that worked for them out of the box. So I created my own. And nonprofits, which tend to be really fast, slow, stuck all over the place, I call them squirrely. I decided that quarterly was too infrequent. Yep. And in the impact method, which is what the framework is called, we do our kind of strategic planning in a cyclical way every 2 months. And I found that that's a real sweet spot because 2 months, basically 8 weeks, you can really get your head around, okay, I need to plan for 8 weeks. And I do the impact method for myself now. And I used to do quarterly. And it was like the last couple of weeks of the quarter, I'm like, what am I doing again? I just feel like a little off track.
It's right where it starts to go a little wanky and you're like,
that's right. Because your brain just can't hold that. And then within those 2 months, we do like a agile style sprint every 2 weeks. So we have a 2 month work plan. And then every 2 weeks we're checking in on the progress of that work plan. And the biggest thing that people learn when they shift to working like that is typically they put too much on their plate at once. And they learn the power of doing fewer things to completion, building blocks, and then stacking on top of them. And that's really powerful to see people, they gain so much so quickly from doing that.
Nice. And I would assume that you see that more in nonprofit, people taking on too much on the plate, just by the nature of the people and by the nature of the project, because you're not necessarily, and in businesses, we have to sell the widget. Whereas right. In nonprofit, it's we're going to help the world, which obviously is a little bit more.
And sometimes people's lives are on the line. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, people, you know, it's people in emergency rooms. It's people who are at risk of dying of drug overdoses. So it's really hard in the heart to be like, I have to slow down or I have to pull back. But the truth is you will save more people if you pick this much more high efficiency way of working. But it just feels kind of counterintuitive, you know, like you right. want to jump into the burning building, but actually just jumping into the burning building is not really probably going to save anybody. In fact, it might kill you too. Burnout is real for everybody. And burnout is just horrific in nonprofits and people tend to be underpaid and overworked. And it's just kind of accepted, which is not good because I think in for-profit, you know, if it's really, really hard and there's really no money, we start to go, something's wrong here. And nonprofits need to be saying that too, but because they're told it's just supposed to be that way, Mm-hmm. They don't, the alarm doesn't sound. It's like, you know, their smoke detectors are all broken. And so I'm often like being like, no, this should be an alarm. This is a problem, right? Like if your people are turning over like crazy, you know, if everybody's burned out, if all your employees have a second job, if your employees are on assistance because you pay them so little, no, like this should be a big alarm.
Yeah, absolutely. So in your work right now, who do you love to serve support? Who is your kind of primary that you're getting the most amount of people from?
I love organizations who are really ready to be super brave and go after the core issue. So I had a client this year who works against intimate partner violence, domestic violence. And they were on a precipice when they started working with me, where they had really been focusing on getting services out to victims, which is very important. But in their gut, in their heart of their business, they really wanted to be taking a stab at how can we eliminate domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And that kind of really, it's hard work. It is not glamorous. There's no quick fix. And nobody knows, you know, exactly how to do it, but they know a little bit. To really support them in making that bold pivot, making mm-hmm. that shift, and to really think about how are we going, talk about like balance those services, like, because it's not as fun for other people. It's not as sexy to fund eliminating domestic violence, because the activities around it are education. They're hard to measure. But so I love it though. I love supporting organizations who really want to do that hard, challenging thing, which I believe is like really makes a big difference. And then otherwise, like, you know, kind of that's connected to people. Like I love any leader, any business person who's ready to be kind of bold, who's ready to try something different, and ready to let themselves experience a lot of joy in doing the hard stuff.
Nice. I love that. So give us an example of one of your Cinderella stories of one of your clients.
Oh, well, I had one client. I've had a lot of clients who, when I first talk to them, they're crying because they're alone, and it can get really hard. And I had one such client she signed up to work with me just before the pandemic started, and she was already overwhelmed because you have to have 3 board members, and all of her board members had pretty much left. So there were 2 left. And so she had to be on the board as well so that they'd meet their minimum 3. She wasn't getting paid at all. And she was basically working full time. They were doing food rescue. They had some volunteers, but they were really good at rescuing food, not just from grocery stores, but from farms. Farms leave a lot of food unpicked. And so they had developed this system of harvesting, actually harvesting that food. And they turned it into delicious. They were like, she was an amazing cook, and they turned it into delicious food. So they had something really good, but they just had like no capacity, like really bare bones, you know, almost no money. No,
as every farming family knows, you can either be in the farm or you can be in the kitchen. You can't be in both places at once.
Right, right.
Yes.
And we started building these systems and processes. We were not focused on fundraising, but we were just focused on let's get an actionable strategy. Let's get the, you know, capacity in place. And within 6 months, nice. She was paying herself. She had hired a paid assistant. She had rebuilt her board. She now had 5 people. And the money just started coming in. People on her email list, there was somebody, I just sent her a check for $2,000. No big campaign. Then a community foundation that she had applied for a grant for just sent her more grant money that she didn't even apply for. And by the end of the year, she, you know, there was still a lot to do, but she took her first vacation for the first time, I think, in 5 years. She took a vacation. And so that's really exciting to me, like to see both personally, like it made such a big difference to her, and for a nonprofit that really is doing something innovative and really important towards eliminating hunger. And to see them, I think they had, the last 2-3 years, they have doubled the amount of food they're able to rescue every year. And so that's really exciting when stuff like that happens.
That is awesome. So what are some of the stumbling blocks that somebody might be having right now thinking, oh my God, Sarah, I need you in my business right now?
If you're thinking, if you're a nonprofit person and you're thinking of quitting, like you're like, oh, I just want to quit, but like this mission is really important to me. Don't quit. Do come for help. You know, kind of like the story I just shared, probably besides just general business stuff, I get great joy and fun out of getting people out of very challenging situations. It is fixable. If you're willing to try. In fact, I was looking back at like a old list of nonprofits who had wanted to work with me, but chose not to. And I was just kind of cleaning up the list, and a lot of their websites were down and their emails bouncing because they had gone under. I've never had a nonprofit go under, and they've been in all the bad situations. So if you're in that situation and your mission is worth saving, come get help. Otherwise, if you're saying, yes, like I want to feel joy while I grow this nonprofit, I don't want to like just be opening up my veins and bleeding every last drop of everything in me for it. You should be able to have both. I think it's actually a sign of a healthy nonprofit when you also have, you know, a healthy amount of free time and brain time. So either of those positions, you can be in a great shape and want to just stay great and do better. Or if you're suffering and you're not sure if you can be helped, you can be helped.
Love it. Hope springs eternal. So I know some of our listeners are going to want more from you. How did they start their journey with you?
The best way is go to pivotground.com. That's my website. If you just like to get some little tidbits to me, you can go to /sign up and join my newsletter where we give little tips that come out of the coaching program every week. If you want to go in full force and be like, yes, I want Sarah talking to me every week, you'll see a button that says apply, or you can go to pivotground.com/application and apply for the Thrive program, where I will work with you very closely and teach you the whole impact method and everything. It starts off with a free application. And if you are approved, you will get a pretty extensive training that I provide, going deeper about some of the things we talked today. And then I'll guide you through every step of the journey from there.
Nice. I love it. So I get to ask you now, at what point in life did you know that you were special, kind of crazy enough to think that you could become an entrepreneur?
So, let's see, I had already started a nonprofit, been the first CEO to setting up another nonprofit that was funded by a corporation, started a media company, started a cafe and bookstore. And then I was starting this marketing agency. And as I was starting that marketing agency, I realized I had a 2-year-old son who's about to be 3. And I realized I needed to leave my husband. And the world is going crazy. I was like beyond broke. And I had my 2-year-old kid. And I'm just like kind of living in my friend's guest room. And I was so excited about building this business. And I moved around and I had to start this business because I had to take over the cafe and art supply store that had been, I had started it, but my husband had supposedly been running it, except I had to run it. And it was, you know, I think I was like $18,000 in debt. So like, you know, I wasn't just starting from zero. I was starting from negative. And I just loved it. I was just having the best time. And that's when I was like, oh, I might be an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. It's like, hey, not many people would do this. Maybe I'm crazy. Hey, entrepreneur, this is awesome.
That's right.
I love that. Sarah, you've been absolutely fabulous and awesome. Thank you. Any last words for our peeps?
Oh, I would just reiterate, you know, great advice is all around you. You've heard it today, but it's not going to do you any good if you don't take action. That's the hard part. So I just, whatever I can send you through the waves of like support and encouragement, handholding, bravery, whatever it takes, send me money and I'll give it back to you if you achieve your goal. Like, get yourself to take action. You don't even have to succeed. You just have to keep trying.
Love that. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it immensely. I know how valuable it is.
It is my pleasure. This was so fun.
Awesome. Peeps, this is Michelle Nedelec. Thank you for being here with us today. Be sure to subscribe to the show and share with your friends. We love helping entrepreneurs grow.
Are you running a business over seven figures but still struggling with technology headaches? Pay attention. You do not want to miss this offer. This podcast episode is brought to you by Awareness Strategies, who is offering a custom-built digital adoption roadmap for anyone running a business over seven figures who's wanting to grow their business in the next 5 years. And it's not just a roadmap. They offer full implementation as well. If that scares the out of you, check out awarenessstrategies.com/roadmap for more details today. The link's in the show's notes. Don't regret not doing this. Do it now. That's awarenessstrategies.com/roadmap.